now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Good news and bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah! See, a United States astro robot becomes a creature of death. Oh.
And Dave.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain.
Back to the House of Pain.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast from class to cult and all the cheese in between. The movies are beef, the entertainment is grade A, and I am your host, Jason Giaconetti, joined by that Mr. Al Giaconetti.
Good morning, Jay, on this very, very rainy day here in New York. Today, we're going back to a time even older than I am. 1944, The Mummy's Ghost.
Yep, and we'll get to it right after this.
No thief that killed Ben, Mrs. Evans. And nothing human tore through that wall.
I'll take her back, Karis. Together we go to Arkham. I swear it.
You can't go in that swamp. It's certain death.
Let go of me.
The Mummy's Ghost was released June 30th, 1944, with a 60-minute running time. Your director is Reginald L. Borg, with your screenplay by Griffin J., Henry Schuster, and Brenda Weisberg. Story by Griffin J. and Henry Schuster. Okay, your star here is Lon Chaney Jr., John Carradine, Ramsey Zamas, Barton McLean, George Zucco, and Robert Lowery. Distributed, of course, by Universal, produced by Universal Pictures, distributed by Universal Pictures. Don't have anything on budget or anything on, box office and stuff, because that stuff wasn't really kept back then. And this was part of the Mummy set of movies that came out post Karloff's The Mummy. And then we have started with The Mummy's Hand. And then there's The Curse of the Mummies, the Mummy's Curse and all the other ones that came along with it. And this is part of the ones when Lawrence Talbot, that was the Wolfman, and it's Lon Chaney Jr. who played Lawrence Talbot as the Wolfman in the, that's what most people remember him from. But he also obviously played Frankenstein, he played the Mummy, and he played Dracula. He's the only actor to ever play all of them, except for the Creature Black Lagoon. He never donned that thing, but he played them all. So, the movie opens with, Anohab, the aging high priest of Arkham, has summoned young Yosef Bey to the Temple of Arkham to pass on the duties of the high priest. So that is George Zucco, passing on the, to, John Carradine, right? to very, very Egyptian people here going out doing this stuff. Where are we? So, meanwhile, in Mapleton, Massachusetts, Professor Matthew Norman, who has examined one of Kahar's missing bandage pieces during the mummy's last spree through Mapleton, also explains the legend of the priest of Arkham and Kahar's to his class, who are less than believing. After the lecture ends, one of the students, Tom Hervey, meets up with his girlfriend, Anami Montessori, a beautiful woman of Egyptian descent. However, a strange, clouded feeling in her mind occurs whenever the subject of Egypt is mentioned. Okay, so this one picks up after the last movie, right? So this is actually still taking place in Massachusetts. Yeah, so this is not the one where we're going to be going off, you know, offhand. So here's what happened. So the mummy's hand was 1940. Then the mummy's tomb was 1942, which takes place into this, right? And then the last one is the mummy's curse, which we know takes place in Louisiana, but we'll talk about that near the end, right? And Kaharis is the mummy here. This is not Imhotep. Imhotep is the mummy, obviously, that Boris Karloff played in the original, and now this is Kaharis. Now, Tom Tyler played him in the mummy's hand, and then Lon Chaney Jr. would play him in the last three sequels. All right. Back in Egypt, Enohab informs Yosef Bey that Kaharis still lives and that Yosef's mission is to retrieve Kaharis and the body of Ananka and return them to their rightful resting place in Egypt. Yosef Bey pledges his devotion to Enohab and explains that during each full moon, Yosef Bey is to brew a fluid from 9 tana leaves, which Kaharis will sense this and find the leaves wherever they are. So the 9 tana leaves, this is very unique to the Universal movies. There is no tana leaves anywhere else in any other. Well, yeah, no, it's all Universal. And anyone who's using it after this comes from this. Now, I'm not saying this doesn't exist somewhere in some book somewhere that I've never heard of, but I don't remember 9 tana leaves in the Bram Stoker's, I forget the name of it, the one Luke will know it, the one about his book about the mummy, like it's kind of about mummies. He has right. That too. But I don't remember 9 tana leaves anywhere else. That seems a very universal.
No, I think this was made up just for the, just to keep the story going. And I have a question, and this I never understood. What does the full moon mean?
I don't know.
I mean, no, the full moon means the wolfman. It doesn't mean the mummy. And then to brew 9 tana leaves.
Somewhere.
Half a way around the world, and the mummy's going to smell it, and then make this trek that would probably take him about 350 years in the walk that he does. I mean, that's the one thing that when you watch these movies, there's no way the mummy can get from point A to point B with that shuffled leg of his in any kind of yep. decent time.
Yep.
And that's where when you watch these movies, that I find that the mummy is not frightening because you could stand next to him and just walk backwards and be faster than he is.
Yeah. Okay. On performing the ceremony, Kaharis heads towards them, but passes the home of Amina, who follows Kaharis in a trance-like state. Kaharis arrives at the home of Professor Norman, strangles him, drinks the fluid of tana leaves. Amina sees Kaharis, which snaps her out of her trance and causes her to faint and forms a strange new birthmark on her wrist. Okay, so if you haven't figured this out by this point in the movie, I'm not sure what you're doing, because obviously they show some, there's some flashback footage that's used to kind of tell the story, but not nearly as much as in other movies. At 60 minutes, this one features some of the least amount of flashbacks to movies and mummies and people playing mummies who are not also Lon Chaney Jr. But the Amina is Princess Ananka reincarnated, right? If we haven't figured this out by now, sorry, spoiler alert, the movie's like, you know, almost 80 years old. It's 80 years old, right? Kind of thing. So the whole point is that she doesn't know this, obviously, and that's why she keeps, you know, getting a faraway look in her eye whenever they talk about Egypt, kind of thing. So, yeah,
you know what, it's really, as you're watching the movie, when she's in a trance state, a black cat runs right in front of her, and you wonder if that was done on purpose or was there a mouser on the set, because I'm watching this and it's the music is getting louder and she's walking, she's coming out. And bam, there's a black cat runs right in front of her. And I said, how appropriate is that?
Wow. Well, remember, cats were important in Egypt too, but they didn't have black cats. They had cats that look like, I mean, I'm not saying they didn't have black cats, but the thing is just a regular, you know.
Yeah, but in a movie like this, I mean, if you're going to use the black cat as a symbol.
Yeah, of course.
You would have a close-up of the black
cat. Yes, I'm saying you would show it, right? Yeah, just, it's just, hey, look at that, you know, kind of thing.
By the way, before we go, just the professor has a really good part because that's the guy who plays the Professor Norman is Frank Reichert.
Yeah.
He was the captain of the Venture in King Kong.
Yeah.
And but his part was he had one of the more professional acting parts in the movie. He's on for quite a bit in the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And without him, you really wouldn't know what the story is.
Yep.
But that was, you know, some all these guys are all universal character actors, and they pop them up here and there. And he had a good role here.
Yeah. Again, they're professional actors. They just need to, what do you call it? They're in different smaller roles depending on the movie. Sometimes the role's a little bigger. Sometimes they have more lines. Sometimes they have less lines. But again, when you're under contract, it means you're just going to keep working, which is the best part because a job is better than no job.
Yeah.
And as we always say, your best ability needs to be availability. Right, so as long as you're ready to work.
Yeah. Amina, one of the things with Amina, as the movie progresses, she has this white streak in her hair.
Yep.
And, you know, was that a homage to The Bride of Frankenstein? Because it sure looked exactly like Elsa Lancaster's white streak.
Yeah.
But if you didn't know that she was being possessed or whatever,
reincarnated,
you're getting back to it.
Yeah. So the next morning, the sheriff and the coroner discover a strange mold around the dead professor's throat, a sign that they both know to mean the mummy stalks Mapleton again. Later, Yosef Bey, who has arrived in Mapleton, calls on Amon-Ra to aid him in his quest and begins to brew the Tana leaves to summon Kaharis. Kaharis heads towards him, killing a farmer along the way as the sheriff soon arrives on the scene and organizes a search party. The next day at the Scripps Museum, Yosef Bey emerges after hours from a hiding place as Kaharis breaks into the museum. Kaharis attempts to touch the mummified body of Ananka, but it disintegrates. Yosef Bey realizes that Ananka's soul has been reincarnated into another form as Kaharis begins to destroy the exhibit, killing the museum guard. Police Inspector Walgreen and Dr. Ered arrive later and decide to use the Tana leaves to attract and trap Kaharis in a pit. Wait.
Yes.
So, the museum. I'm going to say this. When you go through a piece of glass, like a window, it's supposed to be sugar glass. So if they forget to go through, if they forget to replace it with sugar glass, and you go through, I don't know, an actual piece of glass, and you cut yourself apart, most people would probably stop at that point.
Yeah.
But not Lon Chaney Jr., because he's going to do this. They're paying me to be here. I'm doing this. And whatever else might have been going on with Lon Chaney at the time, he sliced himself up really bad going through the glass, all that, and then that scene especially. And you can see it when he goes through, he's like, that's real glass. It doesn't break like sugar. It breaks like real glass. And yep, he cut himself up real bad, even through all the bandages and everything else. So
yeah, this is where my thing is. The Scripps Museum is in Chicago. And yet
Scripps Museum East.
East.
Yeah. This, right. Nothing. Oh. No. They don't say that, but it must be Scripps Museum. East.
But so
it's in Massachusetts.
The thing is, where does the mummy hang out during the day? And then how does he get from being in the country to the Scripps Museum? I mean, it's not like he's catching a cab.
Whole thing is he's supposed to be in Mapleton, Massachusetts. I can't imagine that Mapleton, Massachusetts is so big that, you know, I mean, who knows?
And nobody can know.
No one sees him. It's okay. See, Dad, when you start pulling on the bandages, so to speak, it all unravels. You have to kind of just stick with what we got. Meanwhile, Tom disregards the sheriff's warning and decides to elope with Amina to New York. She agrees, and the two make plans to leave early the next morning. Yosef Bey calls upon Amon-Ra to lead him to the new home of Ananka's soul and then sends Kaharis in that direction to find Ananka. As Inspector Walgreen sets the trap for Kaharis, Kaharis immediately heads towards the Norman house. Amina is awakened by his approach and hypnotically wanders into the yard where Kaharis recognizes her as the carrier of Ananka's soul. Amina faints. faints as Kaharis carries her away. Amina's guardian, Mrs. Blake, phones Tom and tells her story to Inspector Walgreen, Sheriff Elwood, and a large group of volunteers. Kaharis arrives at the mill and presents Amina to Bay. Bay recognizes the birthmark as the symbol of the priest of Arkham. Amina awakens, and the priest informs her that she is the reincarnation of Anaka. All right, hang on there for a second. So there are some great visuals in here. The mill or far, what the heck? It's, I guess it's the mill technically, right? That,
yeah.
The wood plank where he's standing on that wood plank. That's a great model, first of all. But like, there's just some great visuals here of like the mummy and how it's shot. Like whoever's doing the cinematography, again, just some guy working for Universal. Like, you know, the director, all they had a, they're like, all right, let's shoot it this way. They look, I mean, some of the shots are really well composed, well thought out. Things look good for a movie that was made fast. I mean, this movie was made quick. You know, this is an in and out kind of thing. 60-minute running time with some padding in there. So, you know, I can definitely appreciate, you know, the artistic nature of somehow the shots are set up and how, like, the way, like, you have them looking down the ramp at who's there and how it's coming up. It just, it gives you different,
right.
They were good about foreshortening and stuff like that.
Yeah, not a thing. If you have never seen this movie, when you do see it, that ramp is not an easy climb.
Yeah.
It is, I mean, it's at least 50 steps.
Yep.
And he's all in his mummy suit.
Yep. And he's carrying her.
And he's making the step down. One false step and it's Tumble City.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's why I'm saying, that's one of the reasons I think they needed Lon Chaney Jr. Because he was a bigger guy than even Tom Tyler.
Oh, no, I mean, he was strong enough to lift up probably this 110-pound woman.
Yeah, but he's also wearing like probably 50 pounds of stuff. Yeah, and it's not like it's nice. It's air conditioned. That thing's all wrapped on. He's sweating himself off, you know?
Yeah.
You know? So. All right, Yosef Bey falls for Amina's beauty and desires to keep her alive as his bride with the Tana leaves. This plan enrages Kaharis, leading to a fight where Bey falls out of the window to his death. Tom enters, and after failing to stop Kaharis, finds him leaving with Amina. A mob pursues Kaharis into a swamp where he and the rapidly aging Amina sink. The end. Question mark? No, there's no question mark. There should be. Because, you know, and Terra Bang. And if you know what's coming next, you know that swamp runs deep. So deep, it ends up in Louisiana. But yeah, so this movie, again, 60-minute running time. This is a quick in and out kind of film. It's you would think something like, oh, this sounds kind of like could be dull. It actually moves pretty well.
Yeah.
Considering that, you know why? Because they didn't put a lot of filler in it. There's not a lot of, this one has a bunch of story. Other ones, they kind of were like, hey, let's stretch this out by showing you every flashback to every Mama movie ever. This one doesn't have it. Now, the one thing I can say is that when you watch this movie is that obviously it would help to have seen the ones before it because it makes sense what's going on. And that they were really good about basically made one big mummy movie and they cut it up into, you know, four parts. I guess the mummy's hand could kind of be its own standalone. And then like these three could all go together and be one movie, but it's kind of feels like that. So it's not like you watch this, you're like, oh, okay. It's like you watch an episode of a TV series and you know, the next episode is going to pick up, you know, it's kind of like watching Game of Thrones or watching whatever, like, you know, the next episode, they might have a quick recap and then here we go. We're going to continue the story. But that's not how things were made back in the 40s and stuff like that. They didn't, you know, they don't have, TV shows were not like that. They weren't, you know, these, you know, epic events, you know, six part series, you know, like, they didn't have those things. Like TV shows were just TV shows, you know, kind of thing.
Well, back in the 40s, the TV shows, if there were TV, was only on two or three channels.
Yeah.
If there was TV, and not everybody had a TV in their in their house. But the matter of fact, when you think about going back, maybe some of the, like the Thin Man series, but again, it was just the next challenge that
Thin Man ended, and then the Thin Man Returns
The only one that actually continues right after is King Kong and Son of Kong.
Yeah,
and when you watch Son of Kong and it's not cut, it actually begins right after Kong is dead.
Yes,
because then there's the scene of that poster.
Yes,
that is the iconic.
Which people have remade and reprinted. But if you had an original, nope, there are none. There was only what they said. There's only two or three of them. There were just production photos on the set. Yeah. And they said, and wherever they're gone, long gone. But they said, if you had that, they can't even put an idea how much it'd be, the millions it'd be worth, yeah. because it's just so like, and it's a great looking poster.
Yeah. But that's about the only one I remember where one movie ends and the next one picks up immediately.
Cause even,
think about it.
No, the Frankensteins did it too. The later Frankensteins. I mean, doesn't happen immediately, but it does pick up continuity because he is encased in ice,
right.
you know, kind of thing, but it's not immediate.
The first one, he dies in the window, and then the next one, he's got the burn.
He's burned. He's buried. I mean, right, the Frankenstein movies kind of, but things take place in between. There's a lot of living happening here.
Yeah.
These kind of like go and then whatever. But again, it's also supposed to jump years in between.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, it's
not days.
Yeah, it's not days. It's years. It's just hard because I don't think anyone thought about this because let's face it, they knew you weren't going to watch them back to back ever. Because back then, they're like, how could anyone ever afford to have movies running back to back like this? Now we can literally call it up immediately and watch them literally instantaneously, you know, kind of thing. The idea is then. Anyway, it's a good Mummy movie. One thing I say about the Mummy movies that Universal put out, you know, outside of the original, which I've always said should be called the Egyptian, not the Mummy, the four latter Mummy movies, the ones that form this kind of sequence, especially this trilogy, are really good. For what they are, that's what mummies are. That's what they are. Now, you're watching these Mummy movies and you're thinking, hey, these Mummy movies kind of look like Hammer's the Mummy. Oh, they do. Hammer's the Mummy is like the three last Mummy movies all sewn together, which is really, I think, why the Mummy, Hammer's the Mummy, is so effective as a movie, because it kind of takes the high points from these and sews them into one movie. Yeah. And let's face it, they amped up with color. Christopher Lee's really good as the Mummy. Peter Cushing is always Peter Cushing. You know, kind of like they push that envelope kind of thing. But these movies really set that groundwork. And for those of you who are young enough to not know what I'm talking about at all, and you're like, the Mummy, that's got Brandon Fraser in it, right? Those Mummy movies, even those pull from these movies.
Yeah.
You go back and look, they pulled ideas from these movies that were never actual Mummy lore, but Universal made it Mummy lore.
Yeah. One of the things that happened here, this is 1944. In 1953, I believe it was, I'll use the word disgrace for the Mummy, because there was Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy, and it was a guy in a suit with a zipper. And then there was no other Mummy movie until Hammer's movie came out, which took the concept of the Mummy and raised it to back to the level of the 30 movie, the 1930s, because it was done real well. The story was exciting.
And then, it treats it seriously. It's not a joke.
And then again, there was nothing from that time until the Brendan Fraser ones. And
there were Mummy movies in there, but
they were lower budget because Mummies became a kind of like, you gotta remember. So 1968, Night of the Living Dead comes out. Mummies no longer are the slow ambling thing. Zombies became a thing. So I'm not saying all the zombie movies that we got would have been Mummy movies, but if Night of the Living Dead was a Mummy movie, we would have had a lot of Mummy movies.
Yeah. But again, the reason that for me, I never found the Mummy to be frightening. I mean, the Wolfman as a young boy, when we saw that, I mean, it was frightening because God, you go, because everybody goes to sleep at night, or the moon comes out every night, and what would happen if I turned into a wolf and I had to go run around? But until you had the Brendan Fraser movies, in my opinion, none of the Mummy movies were as exciting as any of the other ones. There was no, dramatic. It was okay. There's the Mummy. Let's finish eating your popcorn. Let's watch the rest of the cartoon that's coming on after this. But in the Brendan Fraser movies, the Mummy is frightening.
Okay, well, those movies also, though, Dad, are not horror movies.
No.
Those are Raiders of the Lost Ark. Those are adventure movies. Yeah, those, and the adventures in those movies are in those. Okay, so the adventure in the movies, again, well, as far-fetched, you have to buy into all this stuff. You got to buy in that the Mummy can turn himself in the water and the whole nine, right? But instead of making the Mummy a guy, just a guy, like, Imhotep is no joke, right? He Arnold Vosloo as the Mummy, he's no joke. He's got powers and whatever, and he doesn't stay a mummy long. he stays like he's kind of cripsy, you know, kind of the mummy there, but he turns into a human real quick, but now he's fully powered up. Right. So to make that an adventure movie, like in the vein of the Raiders of the Lost Ark and like the Indiana Jones movies and stuff like that, which people love because those movies are easily pull you right in. You get sucked in those movies and you're watching that thing. It happens. It allowed you to the Stephen Sommers mummy series allowed that to happen. And then to raise the bar as they did. Now people will say the Scorpion King is horrible at the end. Yes. Everyone knows the Scorpion King part is horrible at the end, but if we had The Rock just come out, you'd have been like, hey, it doesn't look like much of a Scorpion King.
Right.
Right. But what they were doing was he was making the adventure movies. And then with the Scorpion King movie, he made Conan. He basically just made a Conan movie, which allowed you to kind of like add on to the mystique was there. And even the one where this takes place with Jet Li, is he playing with the one, the dragon, whatever. Yeah, yeah. Right. That one, while it's not quite the same, it's still a good movie. Like it's still, you were pushing the envelope to what you could do at the time. Right. There wasn't physical effects. It wasn't a guy in a wrap. It wasn't whatever. The only mummies that really made any impact at all be after Hammers is you have the Amazing Stories, Mummy Daddy, where it's played as a comedy with a guy. It's an actor. He's not really a mummy. And it's just he's trying to get to his wife in the hospital who's having the baby, which is funny. And literally in Monster Squad, the mummy in there, right, who's a wrapped mummy, but the mummy in there doesn't do a hell heck of a lot. He's there because you got to have a mummy, right? And it has some funny lines in there, you know, like mummy came in my house, kind of things like that, you know, whatever. But that part of it is just, there's just no, a mummy itself was replaced by the zombie. The zombie is the slow moving, right, because you don't have an army of mummies. You have a mummy, but I have an army of, you know, undead creatures, whatever's coming for you, and they'll eat your flesh. What's the mummy going to do? He chokes you.
Yeah. A lot of mummies are hard. If you don't do it like an adventure movie, the mummy is a hard creature to really get into. I mean, a prime example is the disaster of the Tom Cruise movie
they tried to make that exciting, but it was poorly written.
Poorly written, and it was also boring.
But it wasn't the mummy stuff that was boring. It was the story itself was not well designed.
Right. But I'm saying, it's supposedly a mummy movie, and the story is so poorly written.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say the CGI is bad, because it was pretty good. Remember, at that point, if you had a poor CGI movie, you were dead in the water.
Yeah.
And so when I remember all the trailers, they showed a lot of the mummy doing her thing.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, though, too, is when you look at that, like the Tom Cruise one, it's just not I think they tried to be too smart with things. Instead of just making a straightforward mummy movie, they tried to make it too this and too that. They just tried to turn it too much. And then you need simplicity sometimes in your overall arc of your story to continue on to a monster verse they want to do. Mm-hmm. But remember, you're tying in Russell Crowe as Mr. Hyde or Dr. Mr. Hyde. Mm-hmm. And those effects didn't look great either. That transformation was not done well. But the woman who played the mummy, who some of you might remember from Hotel Artemis, where she plays the assassin, which is really good kind of the movie. But like, I don't think she's the problem. I mean, but the stuff she's in, she can't control what they're writing and what they're leading into. And then remember, it was a Tom Cruise vehicle. It wasn't, having Tom Cruise in your movie, unless you're making a Mission Impossible movie, you kind of are setting yourself up for a certain audience already disliking your movie. I mean, I understand everyone, Top Gun, the second Top Maverick kind of thing. Oh my God, we love it. Because it basically redid Top Gun again. And everyone wanted to relive Top Gun from when they were a kid. But that, as overall, if you took Tom Cruise out of that movie, the second Top Gun movie is fine. Maverick is fine, but it doesn't have the nostalgia part of it. Right. We're not playing nostalgia in the mummy.
Right. But even if you took Tom Cruise out of that movie, I mean, it still is a really good
action. But it has nothing, movie. Right. But as an act, but it's, no, and it's an okay but, action movie, right, but it's not the, everyone lost themselves. Oh my God, have you seen the new one? Because you're trying to relive that feeling they had when, you know, Tom Cruise is playing volleyball on the beach with no shirt on. They're trying to relive that. And it's people who are in their 40s and early 50s who were young at the time in the 80s. We were kids in the 80s, you know, kind of thing. They're trying to get back to that. And that's the nostalgia part. But Maverick itself is a movie. If it just was called Maverick and not, you know, not a remake of the original Maverick, which was that comedy that no one liked with Robert Klein and Mel Gibson, right? Yeah, that and Jodie Foster. So what I'm saying is that movie's fine as an action movie, but it's nothing special. But because it's Maverick and because it's Iceman and because it's characters I know and love, I can bring them there.
Yeah.
So when you make a Mummy movie and you have a movie that has no nostalgia to it because you don't have a history, Romero would make a zombie movie and said it in this time, people are like, well, it's a Romero, because it's a Romero zombie movie. Romero zombie movie means something to people, right? Carpenter's making a Halloween. Well, it's a Carpenter Halloween. Like, it means something. There is no like, oh, well, this is a whoever's mummy. Like, you can't make that. That's why these movies work. Especially these shows, they work because when they made them, this is what sets the standard for mummies. And that's why a mummy is hard to do. If you're going to make a mummy movie as your jump off point for your new universe, probably not the best idea. But they got Tom Cruise involved and they're like, well, people will come because Tom Cruise is here. The days of that happening are long gone. He does not sell the movie anymore. No one is, I mean, and you might disagree, and that's fine. You're welcome to disagree. But Tom Cruise's name as the lead actor in a movie is not putting as many butts in seats as you think it will. Perfect example. In the Fast and Furious movies, and all of them do great business, you are not going like, wow, I can't wait to see Vin Diesel, or I can't wait to see Jason Statham, or I can't wait to see The Rock. You're going because you know all those guys are going to be in it. But you're going to see the most insane stuff possible. You're going for the insane. You don't sell a James Bond movie because it's like, oh, Roger Moore, Sean Connery, Daniel Craig. You sell it on James Bond because James Bond is a brand and you know what you're getting. You're getting a James Bond movie. And whether it's good or it's bad, and however people might feel about like Skyfall or Spectre or the new ones, right? Because some I think are, I've always said this. I thought Casino Royale, the opening part of Casino Royale, the first Daniel Craig one, that opening fight scene where they hold it, that is crazy. And I don't think they've ever matched that again for just pure, like, they've done more spectacular stuff, but that's probably as close to as real as, because he's exhausted and bleeding and like, this is James Bond getting his butt handed to him kind of thing, right? That doesn't happen. And is it great to go back and watch Dr. No and Goldfinger and all the Sean Connery ones? Yeah, they're classics. But no one's taking those away, but it's established James Bond as a brand. And it didn't matter who, slide when it was Timothy Dalton, whether, you know, even the one with George Lazenby, which is actually one of the best ones of all time. It just happens to have George Lazenby in it, right? Kind of thing. And that's why people don't like it. The brand of that is there. A mummy brand doesn't exist. That's why when they redid The Wolfman, which had, you know, I mean, you have Anthony Hopkins, Benicio del Toro, like you got heavy hitters in this movie, right? That movie falls flat. The unrated version is better, but it fell flat because the transformations were CG and they're like, you know, it wasn't physical. It wasn't the werewolves that we were wanting. The werewolves you want are The Howling and American Werewolf in London. You want bladder effects. You want physical, because that's what anyone who's my age, especially, or a little older than me, that's what we know a werewolf is. Right? What you got was the CG and the pulling. That's why Van Helsing failed. That's why those movies didn't hit, because you can't do certain things CG'd. Some things need to be physical effects. The Monster Squad is a perfect example. All physical effects, that entire movie. The werewolf transformation, we don't see him like ripping his skin off. You see the shirt burst and whatever. And it's all done with bladder effect. And it's minimal, right? The mummy in that movie is a skinny guy wrapped up, I think it's Tom Woodruff, wrapped in mummy, poor Tom, right? Wrapped up. And what does he do? He doesn't kill anybody. They rip the bandage off and whatever. But what I'm saying is, but you don't, when that mummy's walking, you're not like, okay, he's slow, but you're not like, oh, look how fake it looks. You're like, oh, that looks like a mummy, because he's dusty and thin, because that's what it would be.
Yeah.
You know?
One thing you have to remember, that the reason that we even got some of those movies is that at one point in Universal's progressing, they got bought out by Comcast, which is the Tom Dolan, he owns the Madison Square Garden and the Rangers and the Knicks, but they were at a very low point, and it seemed that they said, well, we need to make movies to compete with Paramount, because Paramount had all of the Indiana Jones movies. Then they were bringing in hundreds of millions of dollars. Disney was putting out movies, though, bringing in, obviously Disney's different type, bringing in hundreds of millions of dollars. And Universal said, why don't we revisit our history, which is the monsters? And because they didn't make the movies as well as the originals, or at least in people's mind, they fell flat.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem, though, because
Stephen Sommers' mummy movie, his mummy movies hit well,
and that's not Universal.
But the thing is, but that's a mummy movie; they hit well, so they think like we can go off of that. The problem is his movies were not straight horror movies; his movies were action movies.
Right.
And if you try to make a straight horror movie, that's a mummy, that's a werewolf, it better be a really good horror movie. But audiences change, and we know this, and we see it now. And I'm not talking even now. Like the current day, because current day, you probably could make yourself a werewolf movie and get away with it because now people are open and willing to watch different things. But before streaming and before, like when people actually used to go to movie theaters and do things like, you had to catch them and hook them and get them to go back. Because nowadays, I mean, anybody with, you know, 80 grand could go make a cheap movie and get it distributed and get it on Shudder or get it on, right, you know, Horror Box or get it somewhere. And if it hits, a little movie can hit and just be niche and, you know, that niche kind of thing. Yeah. But you aren't making, I mean, what are horror movies now? Horror movies now are blood and gore. And that's not even horror. That's just like, you know, like it's in the because of movies like Saw and Hostel and whatever, you hit the blood and gore movies. Okay. We still get zombie movies, although zombie movies have started to fade out because zombies kind of run their course. Right. We get a vampire movie every now and then. We get a whatever.
You get a ghost movie.
You know, like, but now it's hauntings and stuff like that. Right. It'll become like, or possessions and stuff like that. But we aren't talking about Exorcist, because the new Exorcist and the new Omen, stuff like that. Those are franchises that existed, and they're trying to bring them back. But because of The Conjurings, because of Insidious, because of Sinister, because of those movies, you're getting these movies that push the terror aspect more.
Right. And the terror aspect is what makes you, I mean, when The Exorcist first came out, there was nothing like it.
No, of course
not. Absolutely. I mean, when your mother, actually, we were just married. We went down to the city to see it. And in that movie theater, it was packed. It was at the Lowy State, which held about 2,500 seats. It was packed. And the lines outside, I mean, they kept running it over and over and over again. So you went and saw it at one particular time. But in that theater, because you had never seen anything like this, I must tell you that it was dead silence for most of the movie. And then when Reagan twists her head, there was a baby in the theater that actually started to cry. It scared the living daylights out of people. And so that is a movie experience that you are never, ever going to get with a mummy movie, because you might be invested in watching the movie, but you're not invested in the creature other than, okay, it's a mummy.
Yeah, well, but also the mummy is not, you know, you got to remember though too, Dad, like obviously the book, The Exorcist, you know, the book was, I mean, not huge bestseller, huge bestseller. But the other problem was, is that, you know, and when people went into the mummy, when they went into The Exorcist, they knew like, okay, if this is as good as the end up, because the book blew people away. The Catholic Church came out and vilified the book. And what did it do? It drove people back to the Catholic Church because it scared people to their core. You can't make, I don't care how good a vampire movie you're making. You can't scare people to their core like that. How good a werewolf, how good a mummy, how good a Frankenstein. I don't care. You can't scare people like that to their core. And what happens is, that's why the movies that are more supernatural, the things you can't control, through no fault of your own, you're not doing anything wrong. You didn't do this. And it just happens to you because of bad luck, right? Because of whatever it might be to cause that, right? Whatever there be, you know, through something that's been chasing you, that's the Conjurings, that's been chasing them their whole life. And he passed the curse on to his children. He doesn't mean to. He doesn't know he's doing it, right? This isn't like It Follows, which is a very unique movie where you are literally passing the curse on to somebody else. But when that person dies, the curse comes back to you. If you've never seen It Follows, folks, go watch it. And I'm telling you, just stick with it, because you're gonna be like, what am I watching? It is a weird concept that this curse is following them, but it makes perfect sense when you start watching it, that like this movie, it, and again, it didn't scare me, but it's just unnerving because you're like, right. Oh my God, like what the heck? Right. This is just wrong. Like, but it's a lot like another movie came out at the same time called Ex Machina. Ex Machina is not a horror movie, but it's all about like the artificial intelligence becoming smart and aware and what, but you're watching, it's going, okay, there's more here. There's deeper things. And it's not like it's, and that's not a horror movie per se, but it's upsetting. And when a movie upsets you like that, it allows you to elicit those horror emotions to come out of you. The issue becomes, I don't care how good a werewolf movie you make. I don't care how good, I mean, The Howling terrified people when it came out, right? The Howling's not scary. The Howling is not a scary movie, but it was well made. The effects are good. And now, honestly, in 1982, right? Yeah. 81, 82, right? I mean, to see someone get torn apart, like, okay, and to grow into a werewolf. But we watch that now and we appreciate like American Werewolf in London. We appreciate those movies for what they are. But what are you watching for? I'm watching for, and American Werewolf in London definitely plays it for, you know, some laughs at times too, which helps kind of, you know. But you're watching for the transformations. It's not like you're sitting there going, oh, I'm really scared of American Werewolf in London. Yeah. I'm like, man, look at that. Look at Rick Baker doing his Rick Bakery stuff. You know, kind of look at Rob Bottin doing his Rob Bottin stuff. It, or like
The Thing
is a perfect example. The Thing, now, it definitely gives you some dread if you had never seen it before and you kind of, you don't know. Like once you know, you know. But until you know, the first time when that dog splits up, you're like, what am I watching? Because if all you knew was Howard Hawks is the Thing, which is a really good movie, but it's not, that's kind of like an anomaly for the Cold War also kind of thing, right? This is not.
Yeah.
Invasion of Body Snatchers. At the time, I'm sure it scared a lot of people because they couldn't trust your neighbor. Who can I trust? And whatever, because you're afraid of the big bad outside, right? Those kind of things, they've remade Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The one in the 70s, it's fine. It's not scary, though, right? I mean, it's disturbing at some points, but it's not scary. And then the Invasion, the one they made with Daniel Craig and Nicole Kidman, is not scary. I mean, it's upsetting when you're watching, you know, children get, you know, destroyed and like whatever. That's not pleasant, but it's not scary. But those are more realistic to what could happen in life, and I don't mean happen, than a mummy or a Frankenstein's monster. So the further we get away from something that can attack me for no fault of my own, right? The further we get away from the supernatural, the whatever. I mean, the scariest movies made, I still to this day do not know how people, I've not said this, the movie Contagion, how are you not terrified of that movie? That movie is basically, hey, Here's this virus and it kills everybody. Not turn them into zombies. There's no zombies in the movies. It's not Train to Busan. Busan was just, you know, I mean, that is just unrelenting. But that's a zombie movie. Contagion, it's them trying to stop this from killing every single person they love and know. That's a scary movie in that real. But people don't like real. They like a little bit of away. That's why Supernatural works. But not too far away. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can't be that real. You can't be virus killing everybody, Contagion. So we like the supernatural because, you know, they're like, well, it didn't happen to me. I'm a good person. You know, you kind of, whatever it might happen, right? But you kind of can still have that disconnect. But it's not so far away, like there's a mummy chasing me from a museum. Yeah, it's not like you're at the, you know, you're not like you're at the Museum of Natural History and, oh, the dinosaurs came back alive. Like, we've seen that movie. Yeah. But I'm just saying, you know.
That's exactly right. Any movie that sets off an emotion inside of you, makes you remember it. I mean, we've seen all the mummy movies, but none of them are, I mean, I can bring up because I've been doing this all my life, but let me give you a perfect example. Before The Exorcist, there was a movie called I think it was The Haunting, and it was more talky.
Yeah, but the Haunting's one where all the knocking and stuff. Right. Yes.
But then the other one that said was like the first of the devil movies was Rosemary's Baby.
Oh yeah.
Watch Rosemary's Baby. There's nothing in it. All it is a psychological transformation, and as you watch it the first time, you don't see anything. The hook on that is the end.
Yeah.
When it's a lie. It's, what have you done to my baby?
Right.
And that's what you remember. Do you remember the rest of the movie? The rest of the movie is a typical drama, step by step.
Yeah.
It is not, and it's not scary. It's not scary one bit.
Yeah.
Right?
Well,
when The Exorcist comes out, now the devil is real.
Yeah.
Is real.
Well, the same thing happened with The Omen, because no one knew what The Omen was. The Omen opens, and you have literally people who should be in a romantic comedy or romantic drama. But I'm being serious, though. Like, that's why that movie holds such a place, because the devil is, you don't see the devil the whole movie. It's just Damien. It's just a child. I mean, the dogs in the cemetery are, you know, real dogs and whatever. But that's the whole thing. In The Exorcist, you see Regan rotting. You see her being violated. And like, because her skin's hurts, her face is, you know, decaying, she's bursting and all this stuff that happens. In The Omen, you don't see any of that, but the dread is there the whole time.
Yeah. The thing with The Omen, it's a classic. Mom and I, just before you were born, this 1976, we used to go to Danbury every month. They would have a sneak preview.
Yeah.
And you never knew what the movie was. You never knew.
Well, you know what the movie you were going to see was. You didn't know what the sneak preview was.
And the movie we went to see was with Raquel Welch called Mother, Jugs, and Speed, which was a semi-action comedy, a little TNA here and there. But the theater, the one in Danbury, was a big theater. And it was always packed because you always got to... Because when we used to go, we went to see...
We saw Predator and Predator, RoboCop, but that was down in... I was down in Elmsford.
Yeah. But so... So then when the movie comes on, we're expecting in the audience, and again, it was packed. We're expecting, I don't want to say a Cary Grant movie, but you know, a comedy or something. Yeah. And then The Omen comes up.
And again, it's Gregory Peck and
Lee Remick.
Lee Remick.
Right.
So that could totally be.
But again, it doesn't last. The scene where the nanny hangs herself.
You don't see anything.
No.
You see nothing.
No,
all you see is her jump, and then you see her smash into the window, and then you see her hang, and as they turn away, and it's a fleeting cut.
Now it's, what are we watching?
Yeah.
And then it just builds and builds, and the scene in the cemetery.
Oh, the cemetery is terrifying.
I mean, your skin is crawling.
Yeah. But the thing is this, though, that's what I'm saying is, but people walked into The Exorcist knowing what they were going to see.
Yes.
Right? People went in it. When Star Wars first came out, people went in with an idea like, well, what's this going to be? I mean, who knew it was going to become Star Wars, you know, kind of thing, right? But you kind of knew what you were walking into. When The Omen, once they finally advertised The Omen, then people kind of knew. But if you walked in blind into The Omen, you're like, okay. Like, it's not like the beginning of The Exorcist where they find Pazuzu and they find, like there's no like devil stuff happening. You just like, he lost it. They lost the baby. Well, we have this baby. Okay. So maybe this is about, you know, this story could be The Omen was that they were there to take this child in and give this child a good life. Like, you don't know. Cause at no point are you sitting there. There is no, I mean, was it Jerry Goldsmith did the music for The Omen, right?
Yeah.
Right, kind of thing, I think. Right. His music is not anything super ominous or super whatever. That's when things ramp up. Yeah. But I'm saying it opens in a way you're like, okay, maybe this is about like they're going to raise this child and maybe this child has whatever. And you're like, okay, so maybe this could be whatever. You know, this is a drama, right? We're not going to see anything naturally funny or, you know, whatever, but it's going to be kind of a heart-wrenching drama. And it opens that way. But that's the thing is, it was real enough.
Yeah.
You know, you have things like that. There are movies like The Bad Seed existed and things like that already have been there with the idea of a child being the incarnate of evil. And Damien doesn't do a whole lot. I mean, except for hitting her with the tricycle.
Yeah.
He didn't do anything.
No, it's all mental.
It's him being there and everything happens because it's all, everything around him protecting him. And until you get to the later movies, I mean, he doesn't do anything. He doesn't actually kill anybody. Even in Omen 2, he's trying to save his friend who now is drowning in the ice. Like, it's not him. It's happening because of him.
Yeah.
So anyway, so if you've never seen these Mummy movies, I bought them. They were like, you know, $4 or whatever on Prime. They're available. They're in the Mummy box set, which you can get right on Amazon and stuff like that. All of my movies together. It's
well worth your time. They're not super long. You could actually probably bang out all three of them in one night if you're willing to sit for 3 hours.
Yeah.
You know, and they're fun. And they're kind of popcorn movies. You kind of enjoy your time, whatever. You know, you're not going to, there's no super deep meaning here. You're not going to be like, I now feel fulfilled because I've seen them. But they're fun and they go by quick. They definitely, even though there's a lot of talking, there's a lot of talking with story. So,
well, this one, this one has a lot of talking. The
other one's a lot of flashback.
The one before is a lot of
flashback. But this one also doesn't take place in Egypt, you know, kind of thing. The other ones take like the Mummy's Hand is the first one with Tom Tyler. That one's much more about the story and they're going in and like it gives you the lot. I mean, it's interesting, but you know, I mean, it's not great when he's on the ground trying to lick the tan leaves off the ground, but you know, kind of thing. But you know, he's their own. Anyway, all right, folks. So that about wraps it up for this one. Did you remember watching these as a kid? Do you remember them being part of, I think they were part of Shock 2, because the Shock package was Dracula, Frankenstein, all that. Like, this might have been part of Shock 2 when it came to TV, when they sold the rights through, Universal sold the rights through. Do you remember it? Do you have any of that stuff? We'd love to hear from you. So so that about does it for us, folks. We're going to be back next time with we're going to talk about another black and white movie. But this time it was made that way on purpose. And we're going to talk about Young Frankenstein, Mel Brooks's seminal comedy that it's hard to believe is as old as it is, but it is that old. And we will talk about that next time we're out here, folks. So like we say here, keep those cards and letters coming and keep watching the skies.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which up until a few days ago was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters? Or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots Bugs Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?